This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The UK's digital tech scene is accelerating, and the proof is in the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. This year, we celebrate the next generation of pioneering startups that are shaping the tech landscape of tomorrow. The UK is a thriving ecosystem with access to global talent, cutting-edge research, and unparalleled investment opportunities. Your big idea belongs here. Visit great.gov.uk/UKPA to learn more.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
This is Andrew Peach with World Business Report. Good to have your company. The US Supreme Court upholds its law banning TikTok, but Donald Trump says he's going to have another look.
On behalf of everyone at TikTok, I want to thank President Trump for his commitment to work with us to find a solution that keeps TikTok available in the United States.
We'll hear how budget cuts in Argentina have delivered the first fiscal surplus in 16 years and what might happen to US work permits for people escaping violence, oppression or natural disasters.
They want to end on day one these processes that have allowed for hundreds of thousands of people to come into the country.
First, on Sunday, TikTok will be banned in the US. The Supreme Court has upheld a law passed by Congress imposing the ban unless TikTok is sold to an American company. An ultimatum in response to fears about Chinese control of the app through its parent company, ByteDance. Donald Trump is back in the White House on Monday, and here's the message from the CEO of TikTok to the president-elect.
We have been fighting to protect the constitutional right to free speech for the more than 170 million Americans who use our platform every day. On behalf of everyone at TikTok and all our users across the country, I want to thank President Trump for his commitment to work with us to find a solution that keeps TikTok available.
Donald Trump has said he'll make a decision about TikTok in the near future, which could be pretty good news for TikTok's 170 million users in North America, like these in New York.
A lot of small businesses, even such as myself, like I use it as like a marketing tool. So when people are restricted to express or share whatever they want, that's when people want to speak up against it.
Honestly, it's really bad for us. I know small businesses that they grew up thanks to TikTok, right? And this ban is going to affect not only small businesses, but big corporations as well. Because TikTok, it's like a community, right? And this affects us, everybody.
Adam Siegel from the Council on Foreign Relations is live with me. Adam, thank you for being with us. How did TikTok find itself in this sort of struggle between the US and China?
Well, almost from day one, when TikTok started growing in popularity in the United States, many kind of national security oriented Congress people began worrying about the data that it was collecting and its ability to influence the political debates in the United States.
Obviously, there are many users, many content creators who are prolific on TikTok in the US. From Sunday, when it's banned, what does it mean?
Probably on Sunday, we're not going to see that much of a dramatic change. People will still be able to access it. But the question is kind of over the week, American companies that host the data or provide support to the apps in their stores, if they refuse to continue providing those services, we'll probably start seeing some degrading of services over time and people will find the app harder and harder to use.
So US creators can continue to upload their stuff, but no one will see it?
I think they'll be able to upload, again, maybe Sunday, Monday, but then they'll start having more difficulties of it inside the United States.
Right. Now, we heard the TikTok CEO there who's pretty hopeful Trump's going to overturn it. Donald Trump's been on a long journey about this. He used to be no fan at all of TikTok, and then more recently he's been speaking up for it. We know it played a part in his re-election campaign. We know the TikTok bosses have been to see him at Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, I mean, his change in attitude towards about it is, you know, it correlates pretty highly against conservative use of the app and Trump's influence and popularity on it, as well as personal connections to people who have invested in it. I also think he probably thinks he can use it in some grand bargain with China about trade. We saw Trump act similarly towards Huawei, the Chinese telecommunication company, which the U.S. Has long said as a security risk. And Trump, in that instance, also seemed willing to make a deal that involved Huawei and trade.
It's also a lot of people who love it. So actually overturning the ban, being the savior of TikTok in the U.S., might be pretty popular.
I think that's right. I think, the U.S. government has not done a great job of explaining to the American people what the security threats and risks truly are. And, you know, we saw with a lot of Americans this week rushing to use Chinese apps, like literally inside of China apps, Little Red Book and Lemonade, in a kind of mocking way, that they're not really convinced that it's a risk and they're pushing back against it.
Well, it might just have got to a point where it's become such a part of people's lives that they don't want to give it up, regardless of what the risk is or isn't.
I think that's right. I mean, if you already probably think that your data is being misused by lots of people, and this is such an important part of your life, it's part of your livelihood, the risk doesn't seem that great.
Adam, thank you. Adam Siegel from the Council on Foreign Relations, next to Anne Kokas, who's the C.K. Yen Professor at the Miller Center and Professor of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. Anne's book is called How China is Winning the Battle for Digital Sovereignty. And Anne, thank you for being with us. That's exactly what this is about. What is the risk? What are the security issues here with TikTok? Seem to have lost our connection to Anne, so we'll try and get her back and talk to her a little bit later in the program. We'll come back to Anne in a little while here on World Business Report. Chris Lowe is Chief Economist of FHN Financial. Hi, Chris.
Just sent her an email right now.
Is Chris with us?
I'm right here.
There we are. Right. Now, give us your take on what's happening with TikTok, because actually you've got some pretty close connections with it.
Well, that's right. Yeah, my daughter is in digital ad sales with TikTok, and she's also a big content creator. So it's two significant income streams for her. We've had conversations about all this stuff because I work for a big bank in the U.S., and we're actually banned from we cannot have TikTok on any of our devices. Our compliance people see it as a significant security threat. So it really does come down to, I think, whether, what you're doing in social media outweighs your privacy concerns.
Mm. And give us a sense of how this is being received. We sort of get the politics of it, but for tens of millions of Americans, especially young Americans, for whom TikTok is part of their lives, it is for my teenage children here, what do they think about it being banned and the argument about it?
I think that the real thing they would miss is the sense of community. For many of them, this is where they connect with people, and they connect on a daily basis, and that connection would be lost. And they say they you just don't get it at Meta or on X because the algorithm isn't as good. It's not as good at matching you with people who really share your interests. And, as a business person, really share an interest in whatever it is you're trying to sell.
We'll come back for a little bit more with you, Chris, if we can, in a few minutes on the programme. Other stories to discuss shortly. But I do want to go to Anne Kokas now, the C.K. Yen Professor at the Miller Centre, Professor of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. And Anne, what I'd really like you to add into the conversation is what the risk is. What are people worried about with TikTok?
So they're worried about several things. The first is the large-scale data gathering and thinking about the ways in which it's possible to target individuals, to target communities, and mis- and disinformation. There are also concerns about issues of contested logistics. So when we think about the U.S. and our relationship with China, the ability to control and have a lot of authority over important communications platforms is really essential. And then we can also think about these questions of economic competitiveness, TikTok outcompeting U.S.-based platforms because of their ability to because of ByteDance's ability to gather data in both the United States and in China.
And the difference between TikTok and other social media platforms, you know, Chris was just saying, well, maybe the algorithm works rather better for users. But I guess the difference is it's owned by China or perceived to be connected to the Chinese state.
Well, I think both of those things are connected. Because of ByteDance's headquarters in China, they're able to gather data in China through the Chinese platform Douyin, as well as in the United States and other countries through TikTok, which contributes to being able to develop a more robust algorithm that includes a larger array of a larger population. So that's an important thing to note here when we're thinking about the economic competitiveness argument. But then also the ownership structure is really key here, because ByteDance owns because TikTok is a subsidiary of ByteDance, unlike U.S. companies that are based here. Now, the important red herring to note here, though, is that because of the lack of kind of robust data broker laws, meaning the limitations on the ability to sell data, there are still ways for other firms to gather data from U.S. platforms.
Do you think, in the end, it's possible to ban something that people are so keen to have? Well, Donald Trump, in the end, you know, want to be the person who stopped the ban, but used it as a lever to get something else.
I mean, I think this is really the million-dollar question, or probably more dollars than that, given the money at stake. But I think that there is the possibility of banning it, but if there's the political will is another huge question. There has been reporting that Shou-Chu, the CEO of TikTok, will be an honored guest at the inauguration gala. That will be interesting to see. So how those relationships all play out within the U.S. governmental context, I think, is really important to look at as we move forward.
And it's been around a while. So if it's so clever and the algorithm is harvesting all this data, you'd think it would have been used against us by now if there was any great problem with it.
Well, I think there's a really big question about what does it mean to be used against different democracies. We've seen, for example, a huge amount of fractiousness in democratic elections. If we look to the case of Romania, if we look to the recent U.S. election, if we look to reports on discussions about Israel and Palestine on the app. So what we can think about in terms of mis- and disinformation or the erosion of democratic norms through the social media platform, I think is something that's important to look at.
And thank you. That's Anne Kokas. This is World Business Report with Andrew Peach here on the BBC World Service.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
for this. Next to Argentina, which has reported a fiscal surplus for the first time in 16 years as a result of comprehensive budget cuts implemented by the president, Javier Milei. He took office just over a year ago, promising to cut government spending. He's certainly done that. He said the populist policies of previous left-wing governments had created a cycle of economic decline and hyperinflation. He sacked thousands of public sector workers. He's cut subsidies to gas, electricity, bus fares and university education. Amy Booth is executive editor of the Buenos Aires Herald and live on World Business Report with me. Amy, I suppose he could say, well, this is what I said I would do and I've achieved exactly what I set out to.
Yeah, and in fact, that is what he's arguing because, you know, Milei has long argued that, you know, Argentina's problem lies in the economy and that if Argentina can adopt these sort of more free market policies, more economically orthodox policies, then almost everything else will sort of right itself. It's almost a throwback to neoliberalism in some ways.
Right. But the effect of it is to throw a lot of Argentinians into poverty and to cause all kinds of problems for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, in fact, something that Milei was quite quite vocal and quite explicit about, even from the day that he took office. You know, so quite unusually, in his inauguration speech, he told people that they should brace for a wave of, I believe he said, around 40% inflation a month back in December of 2023. And he did, in fact, go on to his policies brought about a recession, which hit Argentines very hard last year. You know, we were seeing very high poverty rates, certainly in the first half of 2024, as Argentine society sort of bore the brunt. And I think the question now is how that is evolving. So at least officials are starting to say that they're seeing poverty figures come down a bit because we're sort of we're recovering from that recession. But I really think the question is how Argentina's economy is going to perform in 2025, because there's still a lot we just don't know.
And what does he do next? What does he say his plan is now the fiscal surplus is there?
So he has said that he's going to proceed to a second phase of state cuts. Milei famously campaigned with a chainsaw at campaign rallies to show just how much he was going to cut back on the state, which he sort of portrayed as this corrupt actor full of people living on unjustly claimed taxpayer dollars, or pesos, I should say. And, you know, he called that his chainsaw plan, and he said that it's now time for the deep chainsaw. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but in the past few weeks, we've seen some really aggressive cuts, for example, to the Human Rights Secretariat, which does very important work on Argentina's dictatorship. So that's been pretty disturbing.
Amy, thank you. Amy Booth from the Buenos Aires Herald live with us. Now, there's a cold snap in Washington. It's going to feel like minus 15 there later. That means Donald Trump's inauguration is now indoors rather than on the steps of the Capitol. The last time that happened was when Ronald Reagan began his second term in 1985. Hundreds of thousands of people were expected to turn up to see the ceremony, but there will still be lots of private parties in Washington and elsewhere. This year, the level of donations for all of this is bigger than ever. Let's talk to Alice Alstein of Politico about it. Alice, thanks for being with us on World Business Report. How is all this paid for?
Yes, so corporations are pouring unprecedented sums of money into the transition, despite the fact that, as you just mentioned, it's now set to be a much smaller indoor affair than originally planned. And it is far beyond what the inaugural committee for Trump received when he was taking the oath of office for the first time around. And even that was a record at the time.
And you'd think, you know, judging by what happened on the 6th of January 4 years ago, that big corporations would have wanted nothing to do with him ever again.
So we have seen a real turnabout in corporate America, where companies that made very public pledges not to give money to people associated with January 6th, which, of course, you know, Trump, you know, encouraged lawmakers to refuse to certify the results of the 2020 election. And yet here we are. Some of those same corporations today are just giving upwards of $1 million each to Trump's inauguration, which it really shines a light on how few guardrails there are around donations to the inaugural committee, unlike campaign donations, which have much stricter limits and disclosure requirements. You know, we really don't have any limit on the money companies can give. And a lot of folks, you know, both some members of Congress and outside experts, think this is a real opportunity for corruption and influence peddling.
Obviously, you know, cozying up to the new president carries all sorts of advantages, potentially. It's a huge thing. People are familiar with the outside version because we've seen it so many times, but there are also lavish balls that take place inside, all costing loads of money. Who's on the list of donors? Do we know?
Oh, yes. And so companies familiar to many, the biggest tech companies in the world, the CEOs of Uber and OpenAI gave money, big car companies, Toyota, Ford, General Motors, the drug maker Pfizer. And we're also seeing, and this is new, a lot of those I just mentioned are not new, but what's new is the vast amount of money that's coming from the cryptocurrency sector at a time when those companies are really working in Washington to make sure they are not heavily regulated.
And will they be disappointed that the thing has been scaled back, or does that not really matter?
So this is what's being scaled back and moved indoors is just the taking the official oath of office. And so I doubt these wealthy folks were eager to be out in the cold anyways. And like you said, there will still be plenty of lavish parties, not just on Monday, but all weekend leading up to it all around Washington.
Alice, thank you very much indeed. Back to Chris Lowe now, Chief Economist at FHN Financial in New York. It's the last working day of the Biden administration, ends on Sunday. The narrative we've become used to is that Joe Biden was voted out of office on the basis of the performance of the economy. And, you know, a lot of voters will have felt the pressures of inflation and felt all of that. Actually, in terms of the markets, they've done pretty well under Joe Biden, haven't they?
Well, that's right. Trump is inheriting a strong economy and very buoyant stock market. GDP growth was 3% last year after inflation. It's going to be close to that this year. Stock market is up 40% over the 4 years that Biden was in office. It's a tremendous performance. Now, of course, part of that is because there were big tax cuts right before the pandemic, and those tax cuts remain in place now. Corporate profit margins were wide, and that's one of the reasons stocks did so well. So it's hard to say necessarily who deserves the credit, but there's no question you can't really blame Joe Biden for a weak economy. It's strong.
Would you expect it to get even stronger and the markets to do even better now Donald Trump's back?
Well, it might do. Part of this is going to be tricky. And in particular, there's been enormous government spending in the last couple of years, particularly the last year of Trump because of the pandemic, but throughout the 4 years of Biden as well. And if Trump is really serious about weaning the economy off of that public sector money, then there's going to have to be a new push for growth in the private sector. It could be a tricky transition.
Just a quick word about growth in Britain, which has been the focus of political attention. Actually, the FTSE 100 got to its highest ever level.
Yeah, which is also very interesting. The economy there not doing as well, but of course, profits are doing just fine, or well enough anyway, to lift stocks. And I think that a big part of that is because UK exports are doing better than they were last year.
Chris, thanks ever so much. That's Chris Lowe from FHN Financial in New York. Now, immigration is a high-profile public policy issue in many countries, including in the US. The Biden administration, which has just a couple of days left now, has used its immigration powers for something known as humanitarian parole. The idea is to provide work authority in the US for people who are escaping violence or oppression or natural disasters in their home country. But what might happen next with the new administration? Well, my colleague Elizabeth Trovel from our US Partners Marketplace is here to explain.
This is the story of a big sister, Marilyn, and a little brother, Jonathan. Both were university students back home.
Somos de Nicaragua.
In Nicaragua, universities have been a target of the violent authoritarian government. We're not using their family name because of the risk of persecution.
No hay libertad de expresión.
There's no freedom of expression in Nicaragua, says Marilyn, and no job prospects. So 2 years ago, when President Biden opened up humanitarian parole for Nicaraguans, their stepdad, a U.S. citizen, sponsored them. Within weeks, they were on a plane to Houston, and within months, she and her brother landed jobs as custodians at a local school district with their work permits.
Nunca había trabajado de limpieza.
They had never worked cleaning jobs before, but the pay was decent, $12 an hour, more than salaries in Nicaragua. And she felt good about making her way. Humanitarian parole has been a useful tool to getting fleeing migrants quickly into U.S. jobs that are often low-paying and hard to fill.
Food production assistant, forklift operator, gardener.
In her office at the Refugee Resettlement Agency, YMCA International Services in Houston, Joanne Pantaleon reads off a list of jobs filled by her Cuban, Afghan, and Ukrainian clients on humanitarian parole.
Security guard, cashier, Uber driver, packer, stalker, babysitter.
Just last year, her organization helped around 1,800 Cubans, Afghans, and Ukrainians with humanitarian parole get work permits.
It's immediate access to employment. They're making money for themselves. They're contributing to pay their bills.
And in the last couple of years, she says those work permits have been processed more quickly.
Just the fact that it only takes a month and a half or 2 months to get it from the moment you submit your application, it's a vast improvement.
Humanitarian parole has been used in unprecedented ways during the Biden administration, though it's actually been around for decades, since before the U.S. had an asylum and refugee system. But a big difference between today and back then is
Congress used to pass adjustment acts.
Kathleen Bush Joseph with the Migration Policy Institute says Congress used to recognize that people couldn't go home for humanitarian reasons. So they'd say,
we're going to set up a process for you to be able to become a lawful permanent resident and perhaps eventually a citizen.
Congress hasn't had the political will to do that in recent years. And humanitarian parole is both fleeting and discretionary. So when Donald Trump takes office,
his officials have said that they think the Biden administration's use of parole has been illegal. And they want to end on day one these processes that have allowed for hundreds of thousands of people to come into the country.
And even absent Trump administration policy changes, parole is expiring for many. Some have been able to apply for asylum or temporary protected status. Others will return home or stay in the U.S. undocumented. As for Jonathan and Marilyn from Nicaragua, their pathway to stay is their dad, who has a green card. But because Jonathan was under 21 when he entered and Marilyn was older, they're in different immigration lines, facing different visa wait times. He gets to stay in Texas, but she has to go back to Nicaragua. And she's afraid.
Tengo realmente miedo. No sé qué va a pasar.
For now, she's had to turn down a promotion at work as she makes plans to return to Nicaragua. But she's grateful for the 2 years she was allowed to live in the U.S.
Pude económicamente hacer un poquito de dinero.
Unlike in Nicaragua, here she's been able to make some money, she says, and she's actually felt free.
There's more about today's stories online at bbc.com/business. From me, Andrew Peach, and the team on World Business Report, thank you for being with us.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.